Hello everyone and welcome back to the History of England, episode 450, Beat Your Drums. Last time we welcomed James II of Great Britain to the thrones of the Three Kingdoms. This was an opportunity to discuss the much-disputed historiography of the Glorious Revolution, a title which nowadays absolutely requires quotation marks around it, or else be consigned to eternal fire. Which might or might not be just around the corner, depending on your view of plot spoilers. Now, I am forced to admit that the episode caused a little bit of outrage from the pews of this parish, and I would like to formally apologise and try to put that right. The issue is that I made no mention whatsoever of the single most important source for the period, namely the Ladybird Kings and Queens of England, which is indeed a grievous sin. However, as it happens, there is no dedicated title for Jimmy 2 and 7, just a single page of which two paragraphs are all he gets. The picture it comes with, though, is fantastic. James dropping the seal into the River Thames. Won't tell you why. Plot spoiler, obviously. So, this is the judgment of the Ladybird Kings of Queens of England. James II was brave and intelligent, but he was a Catholic. And his two aims were to make England a Catholic country and himself an absolute monarch. There then follows a plot spoiler, so I will leave that out. And then Jonathan of this parish got in touch and he sent me images of the pages. That is so kind of you, Jonathan, because this turned out to be a much newer edition, 1981, if my skill at Latin numerals is sufficient. This had much more text than the old one. Pictures are also great. And they are just as uncompromising and beat around no bushes whatsoever. James intended to make England a Catholic country again and rule according to the divine right of kings with total power. The phrase outrageous king is also used, and James apparently flees because he became afraid he would have his head chopped off, like his father. It's very straightforward, not a hint of revisionism anyway. So I hope I have hereby righted my outrageous wrong, and that I in turn will not have my head chopped off, with many thanks to Jonathan for saving my life. Last time then we also talked about fears that, given the kerfuffle of the exclusion crisis, James would not be welcome to the throne of England. And on his death, in fact, Charles had been pretty gloomy about his prospects. When my brother comes to the throne, he will be obliged again to leave his native soil. But actually, Charles had prepared the ground very well for his brother. The Tories and Anglicans were well up to welcome him as the embodiment of supreme majesty, law, and defender of the Anglican Church. And the promises that he made in February 1685 in the first flush of enthusiasm to defend England's religion as established in law seemed to confirm there was no egg more good. And anyway, he probably wouldn't be around for long, and Queen Mary had failed to produce an heir, so there would be only a Catholic monarch for a short time anyway, before his Protestant daughter by his first marriage succeeded him. This unfortunately also meant James was a man in a bit of a hurry, because he probably read the situation in exactly the same way. So he expected to use his royal powers to advance the cause of Catholicism, and that once the light shone on the people in his kingdoms, there would anyway be a stream, a cascade, an avalanche of conversions. A Jesuit had written to his colleague in Germany with an upbeat assessment, quoting James as saying that he would either convert England or die a martyr. And when said Jesuit had suggested that he might want to take things slowly, little by little, don't scare the horses, that sort of thing, James had poo-pooed him and had replied that he was growing old and must take large steps. Now, he would start in Scotland, he thought, because as he said in his letter to the Scots, to distinguish the confidence he had in the Scotch nobility and gentry who had stuck so close to him in his adversity, which meant that they would do duty to us in the same manner and in being exemplary to others in the demonstrations of affection to our person and compliance with our desires. Also, the Scottish Parliament was easier to control than the English because it was unicameral, so all the MPs were under the eyes of their lords when they voted, and the agenda was set and controlled specifically by the King along with the Lords of the Articles, with much less room afterwards for debate. James, like Henry VII in England 150 years before, saw Parliament simply as an extension, an enhancer of his royal will. So, the Scots were to sit in April, and in England, Parliament would sit in May. James could not have been better pleased with the result. At the start of the Parliament, his commissioner, the Duke of Queensberry, reiterated his King's commitment to defend and protect religion as established by law. And with that said, he asked his loyal Parliament to assert the rights and privileges of the Crown, so that together they develop effective ways for destroying that desperate, fanatical and irreclaimable party who had brought us to the brink of ruin and disgrace. He's talking their language here because he's talking about the hotter kind of Presbyterian and Covenanter, groups like the Cameronians, who rejected royal power over religion completely. And it's a canny move. So whatever his beliefs in toleration, and most historians believe it was genuine, nonetheless, he equated radical Protestantism with rebellion and sedition, and so did his Parliament. And on several occasions, the Presbyterians of the Southwest had given evidence of just that. So their country was now garrisoned by watchful and frequently brutal government soldiers because the Scottish elites were terrified of a return of the Covenanter regime and the revolution. They were therefore very keen to empower their king as a bulwark against the Presbyterians, always assuming he was as good as his word in defending the church as established in law in 1660. And so they delivered for him, in spades. In fact, they delivered plus size. They celebrated 2,000 years of hereditary monarchs, 111 of them, and they professed damnation to all who did anything contrary or derogatory to the king's sacred, supreme, absolute power and authority. They voted the customs and excise for James, as was customary, but they did not give them for just his life. They gave them to the monarchy in perpetuity, forever. Here you go, fill up your boots, cut my own throat if you don't. They extended the test acts a little further to make them harsher, and they voted an extra subsidy of £216,000 Scots when the news came of a rebellion approaching them from the exiled Earl of Argyll, a man who had been forced to flee in 1681 to the Netherlands and been convicted of treason in absentia. So look, job done. Oh, and while they were at it, they added to the penal laws against Presbyterians. Even talking positively about the Covenant now was treason. Attending a field conventicle was now a capital offence. In the memory of the Presbyterians, the Covenanters who had run Scotland and tamed its kings in the Revolution, this was a terrible Parliament. More cruel acts of Parliament enacted in this tyrant's time than the former made in all of his reign. They would not forget the persecution and death visited on them since 1660. They would wait and watch, and there would be a reckoning. The English Parliament met then on May the 19th, 1685, by which time news had arrived of said rebel landing by the Earl of Argyll in the west of Scotland. So there's a bit of context, a bit of background about how people might be feeling. James laid out the role of Parliament in his view, which was to do what he told them to do it when he told them. Oh, and to be quick about it. He started by telling them, "Cross my heart and hope to die, I mean, everything I said about defending the laws and church as established, cut my own throat if I don't, gov." And then he gave them some pointers as to their conduct. "Do not, under any circumstances, try that thing of feeding me from time to time by such proportions as they shall think convenient. Do, under all circumstances, comply with me in what I have desired, and that you will do it speedily. So that seems nice, simple, and clear. And to be fair, James was not facing a tough crowd. The days of Shaftesbury were long since gone. Charles's purge of the early 80s had swept Whigs away from positions of influence, and where they still sat, crawling out like toads from under upturned rocks, there was always dirty tricks to put them back there. Elections back then loved a few tricks, dirty or otherwise. Just one example for you. At Leicester, the Whig Edward Abney was hot to contest this new election. He lined up all his supporters for the big day, 16th of March, and he headed off down to the hustings with them all, full of confidence. Too late. The Tory sheriff had already held the elections on the 13th and not seen fit to tell anyone except the Tories. Sweet. So, the vast, vast majority of MPs were Tory, Anglicans loyal to the majesty of the crown. Of 517 MPs, a mere 57 were Whigs. But the truth is, it wasn't all manipulation by any means. Charles had used the power of the crown, but he had also won the argument of authority versus chaos. The composition of the House probably reflected the mood of the nation at that time. It stood tall for King, Church of England, custom and law. And so rather than flicking a few V's at the King's peremptory instruction to do the dead ant thing, roll over and wiggle their legs in the air, that is broadly what they did. Not quite to the Scottish extent, though. They voted James the same normal income as his brother had got used to, and customs and excise, though only for the customary life rather than monarchy in perpetuity. They did, however, underestimate the customs yield. It turned out too much higher, and as a result, James's income would go up from Charles's 1.3 million a year to 2 million a year. So James was flush. Whatever went wrong with Jimmy's reign wasn't lack of money. The Licensing Act was also renewed. Roger Lestrange would eagerly continue his happy work of censorship and shagging. So Parliament was a great success. James was delighted with his Parliament. He might not quite have grasped the nature of the deal, though. He might not have fully understood that all this cheerleading and bunting hanging out was based on one central and absolutely critical assumption, that he would in turn live up to the promise in his declaration to stand by and support the authority of the Church of England with all his might, including the penal laws that underpinned its supremacy. And in this regard, there was an early sour note, a discordant strand to the sweet melody. A committee of 330 MPs voted to ask the King to vigorously execute the laws against dissenters. James did not think kings should be told what to do, so when he received it, he took great offence and told his court-controlled placemen MPs to make this absolutely clear to the others. The MPs hurriedly backed off. The story so far, then, has been pretty much as positive a start as you could imagine to a reign. James is off to an absolute flyer in all three kingdoms, including Ireland, which I haven't mentioned because they didn't have a parliament, but there, expectation is very high for his reign. There are some voices objecting, but they're very much off the main stage and they're distant and faint. There are two qualifications to make about this positivity, though. The first is just to make the point yet again that this support is conditional on James delivering on his promise to maintain the established churches in their dominant position as embedded in law. The other is that within 6 months of his accession, James will face two rebellions, one in Scotland, one in England. So let's hear how he deals with those then. Archibald Campbell was the 9th Earl of Argyll, who came from a Covenant background, had refused to take the Test Acts in Scotland while James had been in control there in Charles's reign, because it recognised the King as supreme over church as well as state. He had skulked for quite a while in London after escaping from Edinburgh Castle where he'd been banged up, and he lived with a wealthy, fiercely passionate Baptist and political activist called Anne Smith. And together they did a bit of fomenting and plotting, but then government agents got on their tail and he fled to the free air of the Netherlands and took up there with various Scottish exiles who were hanging around, most of whom, it has to be said, he annoyed with his inflated sense of his own importance and his terrible burning resentment at this lowly position he was in. Nonetheless, they continued to foment and plot. Before long, by 1684, they heard of a new addition to the plotting expat community with the arrival of the illegitimate son of Charles II, James Scott, Duke of Monmouth, and Rye House plotter. Now, the Duke of Monmouth was able to rely on plotters much higher up the food chain even than the wealthy Mrs. Smith. The governor of Spanish Netherlands gave him a generous annuity and made him colonel of a Spanish regiment. He was welcomed by William of Orange at The Hague. So there he lived with his long-time squeeze, Henrietta Wentworth, rather than with his wife, Obbs. I mean, this is the Restoration we're talking about. While still Duke of York, James heard about Monmouth's welcome there and he was scandalised, writing sternly to his daughter Mary. Turns out that she, however, was too busy ice skating with the Protestant Duke, from where the French Count d'Avaux reported back to Louis that it was very extraordinary thing to see the Princess of Orange with very short petticoats, those tucked halfway up to her waist, with iron pattens on her feet, learning to slide, sometimes on one foot, sometimes on the other. Well, that sounds all rather lovely. And Monmouth was enjoying it all so much that at one stage he even said he was ready to give up the political ambition he had to do some kinging. But that changed when his dad died. The atmosphere suddenly changed. The Spanish king wanted him gone so as not to annoy this new English Catholic king, and even William of Orange was forced to officially ban him. So, bidding for the position of king once more seemed the best option. It seems obvious then that Argyll and Monmouth should have hooked up ages ago, but in fact they hadn't. But now they did come together in Utrecht. Didn't go that well as meetings go. Argyll was very jealous of the Duke and he wanted nothing to do with him. The Earl was high, peremptory and passionate and parted in that temper, someone said of Argyll. But their supporters said they wouldn't prime a musket unless the pair planned it together. And so, as a result, it was to be a pincer movement. Simultaneous risings, different places. Argyll would head to the lands of his loyal clansmen, where he would raise the clans with the traditional call to war of the Burning Cross. Monmouth, meanwhile, would go to the West Country, where he'd had such a successful progress back in the day. He might have squeefed out when his agent reported a lack of enthusiasm. People were cold, he wrote. But Monmouth pressed on, and he heard news that there would be coordinated risings in Chester and in London by his supporters as soon as he turned up, so that was encouraging. Both he and Argyll were bankrolled by women, Argyll by Anne Smith's 10,000 quid, which is a whopper, modern equivalent of 1.2 million, so Argyll had 300 ships and 300 men. Sadly, all Monmouth had was Henrietta's jewellery and another 1,000 quid from Mrs. Smith, which brought him 3 ships, 4 small guns, 1,500 muskets and 83 men, one of them a Dutch gunner. All they had to do was launch this rebellion at exactly the same time. Well, that didn't happen. Monmouth was behind schedule and then he was trapped in a port by a Catholic wind, while Argyll had sailed up via the Orkney Isles down the west coast and landed at Tobermory on the 11th of May. One of the men with him was Richard Rumbold, by the way, of the Rye House plot. Once a rebel, always a rebel. Argyll put out some stirring proclamations, which basically focused on lay down your life to make me great again. I exaggerate for effect, but not much. So later he was pressurised to give people some idea of what risking their lives in rebellion might gain apart from that. So Argyll's banner then read, "For God and religion against popery, tyranny, arbitrary government and Erastianism." Now, as a piece of copywriting, I think that leaves a bit to be desired. Do you not think? I mean, if there are any budding copywriters out there, I have a tip. Erastianism does not belong on any marketing material, not even for a book on Erastianism, I would suggest. There is no sex in Erastianism. This is not the language of populism. Well, the thing is that not only was Argyle's pitch far from inspiring, he was not well loved. The Campbells were famously exploitative landlords and unpopular around the Western Isles. Just ask a MacDonald. The Campbell homelands on Kintyre had been ruthlessly persecuted by the Marquis of Athol after Argyle had fled, as had the other potential source of supporters, the enthusiastically Protestant Presbyterians of the Lowland Southwest, with all those government soldiers quartered through the counties. And so as Argyle worked his way southwards, trying to find support, his army, rather than getting bigger, gradually disintegrated until he was left all alone to flee. He disguised himself to sneak back up to the Highlands. Even that went wrong, and he was arrested by a weaver called John. By the 12th of June, he was in Edinburgh Castle. On the 30th of June, he was standing in front of the Maiden. I really shouldn't be blathering about this. I should be getting on with Monmouth. But you know, it is my podcast, and so I'll blather about this if I want to and all that. So the Maiden was a guillotine in use for a couple of hundred years before the French claimed it. One big difference, though, was that you lay on your back looking up at the blade. That sounds deeply uncomfortable to me. Anyway, as he was there, gazing upwards, Argyle saw that the blade was a little bit wonky. So he had some tools brought, measured it up, had it set straight before making his speech. I like this story for sang-froid, obviously, although no engine of destruction subjected to my level of DIY skills would ever be capable of taking anyone's life. But maybe that was what he was about. I do not know. Sadly, though, the story does seem to be untrue. Instead, the sight horrified him and he asked to be blindfolded, which seems like a good idea. But then, gross anecdote alert, when the Maiden severed his neck, as the blood spurted out in a cascade, the body gave a massive spasm and leapt upright, blood flying everywhere, until the executioner rugby tackled it to the ground. Yuck. Really. It was not until Argyle was passing into Edinburgh Castle that the Protestant Duke Monmouth finally landed in southwest England at Lyme Regis on the 11th of June. His arrival was greeted with much more enthusiasm than Argyle's had been. "And Monmouth! And Monmouth!" cheered the crowd that quickly gathered. And by the end of that day, 300 men had already joined the rebels. That's a bit more like it. So maybe this version will sell better than the Argyle edition. Monmouth had chosen the southwest of England because it had a tradition of being a home to radical Protestants and dissenters and lovers of the good old cause. So on June 11th, 1685, he gave out his proclamation, which included a demand for toleration for dissenters, but also Catholics, as it happens. He demanded a range of constitutional reforms, very much along Whig lines. For some people, it worked. Estimates vary very much, but the government figured that Monmouth had attracted an army of 6,000 people. Monmouth himself claimed that he could have had an army of 20,000, just didn't have enough guns to arm them with. But the people who came to him were almost exclusively the ordinary people, not the kind of gentry with money and wider appeal that you really needed to mount an effective challenge. Monmouth's pronouncements weren't really attracting the sort of people who had rallied around Charles and James since 1681, because as far as they could see, this was exactly the sort of thing that they'd been worried about during the exclusion brouhaha. Roundhead types, out to undermine the good old C of E and start another civil war. No one wanted that, surely. Still, best foot forward. Monmouth started off northwards towards Bristol, figuring that this was lightly defended and would provide an excellent base with a massive port, while rebellions hopefully broke out in the north and London as promised. As he marched, more volunteers joined, including a group of four young men in their early 20s, by the way, who just a few years before had been schoolmates at Morton's Dissenting Academy in London. Their names were Battiscombe, Jenkins, Hewlett, and one Daniel Foe, who, having recently married, had changed his name to the posher-sounding Daniel Defoe. They marched under the banner, "Fear nothing but God." And so Daniel Defoe enters our story, him of Robinson Crusoe fame. As they marched, they met local Dorset-trained bands called out to destroy them, and there was one sharp skirmish where the Duke's cavalry commander, Lord Grey, was forced to withdraw, so that was a bad start. But then, most of those trained bands deserted, being pretty sympathetic to Monmouth's cause, and it's estimated that maybe half of the Somerset militia deserted as well. So whatever might happen next, it wasn't the local militias that were going to deal with it. So it was a good thing, actually, that James had a professional army approaching at that very time, and maybe 2,600 soldiers under command of the Earl of Faversham, who was a delightfully incompetent commander. So it is fortunate that he had with him a thoroughly competent second-in-command, John Churchill, and also a king who knew what he was doing in a military sense and ordered them to fortify Bristol, which is exactly what they were doing when Monmouth reached Taunton on the 20th of June. Here, to get a bit more momentum going with this, he had himself declared king, while the local council were forced to watch and cheer at sword point. And then onwards to where he planned a surprise attack on Bristol by crossing the River Avon at Keynsham, south of the city, where nobody would expect. But he was unlucky, because a scouting cavalry contingent from Churchill's command met him, and the rebels were turned back at the crossing point. There was a big moment for Monmouth, as it happens, because a bunch of captured prisoners at that point filled his head with tales of a vast, impregnable royal army. And anyway, his surprise route to attack Bristol had been discovered. Maybe at this point he should have kept going northwards towards the Midlands and the north in hoping that others would rise and join him, but instead he lost his nerve. Reports came in that salvation lay in Wiltshire, with support and arms and provision being gathered for him there, and so he effectively started to retreat, which never looks good. He did try a morale booster on his way back at Bath, going to demand its surrender in front of the city walls, where a lucky shot from a cannon blew his herald's head off, which is just not the sort of thing that would boost morale either. On he went, and he reached Norton St Philip in Somerset, which is a lovely place these days, fantastic pub, one of the many claiming to be Britain's oldest, I think. So Monmouth made that his HQ for a while. And there, the rebels came under attack from a hardened pro of the Royal Army, Colonel Percy Kirk. But at Norton St Philip, this Tangiers veteran walked into a hail of fire and suffered heavy losses, maybe 500 men down. At last, the rebels were winning something. Morale rose. This might have been the moment for a bold counterattack. But the rain was falling. The rain was falling in buckets. They were on lowland. The ground was a quagmire. The opportunity was lost. Kirk escaped. That night, Feversham and Churchill saw the rebel fires burning in the town and decided to attack. But when they advanced in the morning, they found Monmouth gone. To Frome, to Shepton Mallet, into the marshy Somerset levels close to Bridgewater, which Monmouth then ordered to be fortified. He now knew there was going to be no spontaneous rising in the north, nor in London, and Faversham was closing in. So he decided he must be bold, he must strike north, get past the Royal Army, burst into the Midlands, there to raise support. It was the night of the 5th of July. Feversham had camped at a little settlement called Western Zoyland, watching him, when Monmouth thought he saw an opportunity. Feversham had deployed very poorly indeed. He'd camped his men strung out in three disconnected units. They were in the open, they were unprotected. Very few scouts and pickets had been set, because Feversham was convinced that Monmouth was beaten and would just keep running. Monmouth was worried about the Royalist artillery, which was far superior to anything he had, capable of cutting them to pieces in a daytime set-piece battle. But they were all focused together at the main road in one spot from where any attack might be expected. So there was a chance to attack the unprotected camp from an unexpected direction, at night time, across the moor, Sedgemoor. Meanwhile, Lord Grey's cavalry will swing around on the Royalist flank, attack in the dark, destroy the artillery and drive the Royalist infantry out of their camp in a panic into the waiting rebel infantry, where, in chaotic hand-to-hand fighting, the advantage of the superior organisation of a professional army would be lost. It was a plan. It was bold. And it could work. So at 10 o'clock that night, they were ready. Monmouth led his infantry out in the dark, in silence. Grey mounted with his cavalry, horses' hooves muffled, the wheels of artillery carriages greased so as to make no sound. Monmouth's advance went better than he dared hope. They met no scouts, and by 2 in the morning they were less than 3/4 of a mile from the unsuspecting Royalist army. But then disaster struck. A shot in the dark broke the night. Maybe a nervous trooper, maybe a royal scout. But that was enough, and from the camp came the cry, "Beat your drums, the enemy has come! For Lord's sake, beat your drums!" Monmouth and Grey were close, though. A quick strike, even now. The daring attack could still work. Monmouth hurried to attack the Royalist camps, while Grey set off as fast as he could, whilst he still had time to fall on the artillery regiment before they were ready, and cause chaos in the rear of the royal camp. But there was a problem. The low-lying, marshy Sedgemoor was crisscrossed with man-made drains and ditches, rines they were called locally. And at this critical moment, Ray couldn't find the crossing places they'd planned to use. In the end, even having to try and cross right in front of the Royalist army, he came under heavy fire, his cavalry broke, and Grey fled. Monmouth's infantry were also blocked by the Langmoor Rhine, and failing to find any crossing at all, they started firing at the enemy way too far away to be effective. The Royal Army was able to take its time to organise, and then came the counterattack. The sun was up now, the rebels were in plain view, the rebel cavalry was gone, the professional army was in good order with cavalry alongside it. So rebel foot soldiers faced cavalry, totally unprotected by their own. It became a slaughter. Everyone ran. Even more were slaughtered. Monmouth and Grey disguised themselves as labourers and tried to escape Sedgemoor to make for the south coast. They were discovered in a ditch near Ringwood in Hampshire, starved and desperate. Famously, Monmouth had nothing but a handful of peas in his pocket that he'd found in a field. He was taken to London, within a few days was executed at the Tower by an executioner so bad that his name used to be used as a synonym for Satan. Jack Ketch, he was called. He had botched the beheading of Russell after the Rye House plot too, so much so that halfway through, Russell is supposed to have asked for his money back. As he put his head down, Monmouth is therefore reported to have said to him, "Do not serve me as you did, my Lord Russell. I have heard you stuck him 3 or 4 times." On reflection, it was probably a bad idea to get lippy with someone whose job it was to chop your head off. And so Ketch took his time. It took him 5 blows to dispatch Monmouth. And the crowd was so incensed watching it that Ketch actually had to be rescued by the guards before they lynched him. Ketch, as it happens, was dead within a year, but he lived on as a character in the Punch and Judy show. He, if you know it, is the hangman who pursues Punch, but then is tricked into hanging himself. Meanwhile, there was those 4 companions of the Mortons Academy, and one of them, Daniel Defoe, made it to Scotland and then over to the continent. In later life, he would write of Monmouth's failure to cross Langmoor Rhine. Had not these accidents conspired to his defeat, he had certainly cut the Lord Feversham's army all to pieces. But by these circumstances, he was brought to battle on unequal terms and defeated. The rest I need not mention. The rest that he need not mention refers to one of these famous events in English history that everyone used to learn about at school. Do they still, I wonder? I do hope so, because it was part of the national folk story. Hanging Judge Jeffreys and the Bloody Assizes. Part of the reason it is so well known was the Whig political writers that later fueled the fury about it. But for once, their invective was not much of an exaggeration. The brutality started immediately after the battle with a stream of executions without trial. The Dutch gunner, just for example, had been pretty much the most single effective person in the whole rebellion. Well, he was strung up straight away. King James had a personal hand in this, as it happens, because he issued the instruction that rebels who proclaimed Monmouth king may be hanged without bringing them to formal trial, and that he would have some of them made an example of terror for the rest. Exemplary justice. Well, mainly exemplary. Probably something like 50 were killed without trial. Percy Kirk, the man beaten at Norton St. Philip, once more comes into the story, and not in a good way. So his men were so brutal that they had a nickname. They were known as Kirk's Lambs. That's irony, by the way. At a regimental dinner party to celebrate their recall to London on the 31st of August, a full 6 weeks after the battle, they had three rebels brought out that they'd kept for later and shot for a bit of fun. I've hardly ever seen that at any of the dinner parties I've been to. We've lost so many of those good old traditions here in today's England. Such a shame. The Chief Justice was George Jeffreys, who had been one of the monarchy's most effective legal bully boys in Charles's Quo Warranto campaign and had been rewarded by James with the barony. In May, James had exacted revenge on Titus Oates, in which trial it has been suggested that Jeffreys maybe, possibly, perhaps, could be accused of leading the juries. Now, I am no legal expert, so let me turn it over to you to decide. So this is old Jeffreys addressing the court about the defendant, Titus Oates. "You are a shame to mankind. The blackness of his soul, the baseness of his actions ought to be looked on with such horror and detestation as to think him unworthy any longer to tread upon the face of God's earth." What do you think? Seems pretty balanced to me. Anyway, the jury did convict Oates for perjury, to be whipped and pilloried, also fined £100,000 and banged up in debtor's prison, which would be effectively for life with a fine of that size. But I have to say, it is difficult to feel a lot of sympathy for Titus. Anywho, it was Judge Jeffreys who led the legal team after Sedgemoor, and the trials kicked off in Winchester on the 29th of August 1685, where hundreds were held in waiting for just that. One of the earliest cases was Alice Leal, whose husband John Leal had been a regicide back in the day. The good judge was almost dribbling as he fixed his glare on the 67-year-old, who kept falling asleep in the hot court, sadly. And he provided a textbook model of judicial impartiality by reminding the jury reasonably frequently that her husband was a Cromwellian and a regicide. At one point telling the jury, "I will not say what hand her husband had in the death of that blessed martyr. She has enough to answer for in her own guilt." When the jury expressed their doubts, he replied, "There is as full proof as proof can be. For my part, I thought there was no difficulty in it." So that's clear then. Against all the odds, Alice was indeed convicted and sentenced to burn. That's irony again. It might well have been assumed that the king would commute the conviction or even offer a pardon. Not a bit of it. Although he did change the punishment to beheading, to be fair. This is a feature of these bloody assizes. James consistently refused to reprieve the convicted, even though this was often the practice. He was keen to have a full example set to those who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. But for Alice, maybe it was all worth it, because she will become an immortal. She will earn a special place in history as the last woman to have been executed by a judicial sentence of beheading in England. Congratulations, Alice. Jeffreys went on tour running assizes in Dorchester, Taunton, Exeter and Wells, and it's also suggested he stayed at the George Inn in Norton St Philip and tried 12 rebels there. They were all convicted, of course, and then they were taken from the George across the road to an orchard and hanged. That place is called Bloody Close now. Dan, Pat and I stayed in the George, and I can confirm that it is just across the road, so it is indeed Bloody Close. Arf, and indeed, arf. We then walked Sedgemoor, by the way, just so you know about my fun weekends, which was indeed very fun. People argue about the numbers, but probably in the order of 1,400 people were tried. Jeffreys was not inclined to mercy any more than he was inclined to impartiality. Many of the rebels were dissenters, and Jeffreys did not like dissenters because, as he indeed pointed out to many a jury, they are to blame for the death of King Charles I. His job was to make the monarch safe, not quibble about legal niceties like, I don't know, guilt or innocence. As he told his royal master, he would pawn his life and loyalty, that Taunton and Bristol and the county of Somerset too shall know their duty before I leave them. In a letter James had written to William of Orange, he casually mentioned that Jeffreys was making his campaign in the West. So, justice is just the extension of war by other means, to pervert a famous expression. Now look, 1,400 people is a lot to get through time-wise, and efficiency was important, so there were shortcuts to help speed things up. Government agents would tell prisoners that if they confessed, they'd be treated leniently, and if not, they would suffer the hideous death of being hanged until almost dead, but not quite, having their entrails cut out and burned in front of them while still alive, and then be pulled into bits by horses. So they'd confess, which meant no need to hear lots of long, boring evidence, and they could be convicted and sentenced to being hanged until almost dead but not quite, having their entrails cut out and burned in front of them while still alive, and then pulled into bits by horses. The sight of so much death brings vultures as well. One such was the lawyer Andrew Loder, who promised rebels that he would get them a royal pardon if they just gave him a little fee, and then did nothing, except, of course, trousering the fee. About 250 people in all were executed, probably. So that meant there was an awful lot of human bits to be processed after all that pulling apart. Those horses must have been knackered. A newsletter in October 1685 summarised what happened to three of them. They were quartered and boiled, and one of them sent to be hung up at Plymouth, another at Dartmouth, and then the other to be hung up here, his head on the top of the shambles, and his quarters at four quarters around the borough. As one historian noted, the southwest of England was turned into one vast anatomical museum. About 850 of the rebels were sent to the Windies as indentured servants, there to spend 10 years in service. They were not slaves, of course, but their lives were cheap, and for 10 years they could be bought and sold. There is an absolutely remarkable story that survives of Henry and William Pittman, who were sentenced to transportation and sold to a, quote, needy papist, who then took a bribe to sell them on to someone nice. And then, of course, sold them on to a murderous brute. William died in the Caribbean, but Henry escaped from Barbados with some others in 1687 to a tiny island where they copied the locals by living off turtles and turtle eggs. He then managed to find passage to the Bahamas and then to New York and then back to Blighty in 1688. His pals, meanwhile, were caught by a Spaniard and enslaved. He wrote, "When they went to sea, we were carried as their slaves to pump ship, wash their clothes and beat corn in great wooden mortars, with negroes with naked swords always standing by as overseers." The last thing to say is that given the vast numbers involved, this process went on for months and months, still going on deep into November, a running public sore, so that even those close to court were sickened by the whole thing. But that does not mean that the rebel cause led to an upswell of opposition to James. Not a bit of it. The learning from the rebellions from May to July was the remarkable absence of any sympathy for either Argyll or Monmouth. So, even if the Battle of Sedgemoor had gone the other way, it is not at all clear that there would have been a different King James, i.e. a King James III and VIII. And James had use of his 9,000-strong standing army that Brother Charles had managed to squirrel away anyway, and so more royal troops had been mustering. There are things both rebel leaders Argyll and Monmouth did wrong. Their proclamations made really no attempt to appeal to the middle ground moderates, for example, certainly not to Anglicans or ecclesiastical Scots. But the real conclusion is that James's position was rock solid. His promise to support the Church of England and the fear of the chaos of a new civil war trumped any sympathy there might have been for the rebels. And in fact, in the short term, it absolutely strengthened James's hand as the bulwark of stability, whose need had been demonstrated by this threatened chaos. He will immediately use it as an excuse to build an even greater standing army. All he really had to do now for a long and happy reign was to deliver on his promises. And we will see how that goes next time. I hope you've enjoyed this rather gruesome episode, and I would like to thank you all very much for listening, and thank those of you who get in touch via the website, Facebook, or email. It is always a joy to hear from you. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.